It's the Humanist Agenda edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, humanism, humanism, and more humanism, as we have an extended interview with BC Humanist Association Executive Director Ian Bushfield. Now let's begin episode 178.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross-sort politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello, this is Don, your skeptical philosopher and free-thinking political scientist. Ethan is taking a little break this week, so we're having a special guest thinker, Ian Bushfield. Ian has a master's in physics and is the executive director of the BC Humanist Association. Welcome, Ian.
Hi, Don. Thanks for having me.
So, as our listeners are well aware, I'm a skeptic and an atheist, but am I a humanist? Ian, can you let our listeners know how you view atheism, skepticism, and how that relates to humanism?
Yeah, well, it's really up to you whether you want to call yourself a humanist or not. To me, humanism is simply just a rational and progressive worldview that's based on science and compassion. Humanist values are especially becoming quite universal these days. I think they're really embodied in documents like the UN's Declaration of Human Rights and Freedoms and in the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, or at least most of it. With respect to atheism, that to me is just the lack of belief in God. I mean, it's not really a big, broad term. It doesn't cover a lot. So most humanists are atheists, but it's not a prerequisite. You know, not everyone has to be. Some humanists are agnostics, deists, or even some are liberal theists like the Unitarians. The way I see it is humanism makes belief in God irrelevant by giving naturalistic answers to the questions that we usually invoke God for. So questions about like the nature of the universe, where does stuff come from, why is there something rather than nothing, and questions about morality, like why be good? Humanism can answer those without God. So while belief in God is irrelevant, in humanism, I think we may as well live as atheists.
Well, that leads to an interesting question then, based on your answer. So you think humanism can be sort of its own foundation for your moral beliefs and for the existence of humanism, but then you say there are some people who are religious and humanist. Doesn't that create some sort of conflict in their own belief structure?
It would seem to, but the way I've been thinking about it recently is it's sort of like, I guess it's just sort of compartmentalization that a lot of people are good at. It'd be like a child who knows that her mom takes the tooth out from her pillow and puts the loony there, but she still believes in the tooth fairy because it makes her feel good. So we have the good natural explanations, and there are some who maybe want something else or just don't haven't been completely disproved God, and so they're agnostic like Neil deGrasse Tyson, but they live their life as humanists. Jean Chrétien and Pierre Elliott Trudeau were Catholic on paper, but they wrote some very anti-Catholic legislation while they were prime minister of this country.
Well, I think we can kind of excuse to a certain degree people who I would call sort of culturally religious. So people who don't see religion, or at least like the Catholic Church or that. Actually, the most notable one would be like the Church of Norway or in Sweden, right? Where it's more of a cultural institution than a religious institution. And that I can understand. But with regards to the idea of religion, and I'm going to sort of focus back on atheism, because last week we kind of did a segment on what I would call bad atheism, where we have people who don't believe in any deity or all that, but nonetheless, you know, they don't really have a good grasp of skeptical ideas, and they hold on to some things like, you know, anti-vax, they can be somewhat racist or libertarian. So this idea of sort of what I call bad thinking, how does humanism deal with that? So you have someone who, you know, is a humanist, but let's say they are homophobic because of their religious views.
Well, the way I see it, humanism requires strong skepticism. Humanism cares about the truth in the world and sees the best way to approach true knowledge as scientific skepticism. You know, we like the words of Carl Sagan, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. But getting back to bad thinking, everyone sort of has those skeptical blind spots, it seems. We all have some bad ideas, or at least there's a number of people who do. Massimo Piglucci, he writes the blog Rationally Speaking, and he just had a great post on this a day or two ago titled The Community of Reason, A Self-Assessment and a Manifesto, because every humanist has to write manifestos or they're not a good humanist. In it, he discusses the many problems he sees with this so-called, you know, skeptical atheist movement, and he tries to offer some constructive solutions. And he does name those blind spots that you point out, like libertarianism and anti-vax and climate change denialism. And he sees the root cause here as being sort of either an anti-intellectualism or a pseudo-intellectualism, which is kind of ironic because we like our intellectuals, but we have a number of people who seem to have gotten almost so self-confident in their intellectualism that they can just dismiss, you know, an entire branch of academia like philosophy. You know, you hear a number of big prominent speakers going, well, we don't need, philosophy's dead, or we don't need to talk about philosophy anymore. We're beyond that.
Well, I think two good examples that we had on last week's show, or we were talking about on last week's show, is where you get someone who is what you would sort of call, I guess, compartmentalized, someone like Sam Harris, who I think in some degrees is a very good intellect and has some very good ideas. But at the same time, I think he's become so self-aggrandized in his own opinion that he's kind of gone off the rails. And then you get someone like Bill Maher, who thinks he's an intellectual, but really just doesn't quite seem to grasp that.
Well, yeah, and it doesn't even have to necessarily be the big speakers or, you know, the big names. You can get just the average person, you know, the average skeptic on the blogs who gets this sort of I'm smarter than thou syndrome, as Massimo calls it on his blog, where it's really easy to debunk something like UFOs or homeopathy. So we get this false sense that we're always on the side of reason and science. And then, you know, you grab that absurd premise like Randian objectivism that, you know, every individual can be their own society, and suddenly you derive some absurd consequences.
True. No, and actually, again, to quote myself in last week's show, well, I am smarter than everyone else. Maxima probably hates me now. No, I was saying, we were talking about how, Penn Jillette was talking about the reason why he's an atheist is because he doesn't want to answer the question. He doesn't know anything about it. Because he doesn't know anything about it, he doesn't want to say anything about it, sort of thing, right? And I think that would make him more of an agnostic. But I think to claim to be something like a true atheist is you have to use sort of the skeptical tools to get there. I mean, you have to assess the opposing beliefs. I mean, that's an important part of any, if you're going to say something about something, make sure you understand what it is you're talking about and you've applied the tools of skepticism. So, I mean, is it a logical argument? Is there any evidence for it?
Well, I think you could be an atheist just by, you know, waking up and never being introduced to religion. When I grew up in a secular household. We didn't go to church. We didn't really talk about religion even. And so I learned all my religion from The Simpsons and from my friends who weren't able to play on Sunday mornings. And so I don't think you have to think your way into atheism necessarily. It can be sort of a natural state. Some people have described it as like, you know, every child is an atheist until they're indoctrinated one way or the other.
Well, and I guess that also goes to one of the debates between atheism and anti-theism. And I guess I am more talking about anti-theism than atheism, because atheism is absence of belief. And I mean, nobody questions about the belief in the spaghetti monster.
Yeah, I think you have to know a little bit about religion before you can hate it.
Yes. I think, or anything. And although history has shown that the less you know about something, the easier it is to hate it. But that's just a sad point. So recently in the news, there was an appearance by our premier on the TV show 100 Huntley Street. For our listeners abroad who may not have known about this, can you tell us sort of what 100 Huntley Street is? And what was the incident that caused so much consternation?
So 100 Huntley Street is this long-standing Christian evangelical talk show on Canadian TV. And our premier, our BC premier, Christy Clark, went on the show, I think it was on August 1st, to discuss the Northern Gateway Enbridge pipeline that's very controversial right now in the province. And partway through her interview, she's talking about where she gets her inspiration to make these politically unpopular decisions that she thinks at least will be good in the long term. Sort of, you know, we have to face our tough challenge and it'll pay off in the long run. And she sort of forced it in there that she says these lessons are ones she learns in the Bible. And so we found that to be a bit contentious. And so our association heard about this, and we put out a press release questioning whether she was committed to sort of secularism in this province. And we stated we were worried that the premier of the most diverse and least religious province in the country might be basing her policies on religious texts. And if that's the case, we really want to wonder, which verses is she using and which ones is she ignoring?
So 100 Hundleds to Yourself is a pretty radical sort of, well, not radical, it's not the right word, but hardcore.
I think it's like Pat Robertson's type 700 club.
Right. So, I mean, like, these are people who wear their religion very much on their sleeve. It's very much everything is kind of related to this. Now, I actually listened to her her interview on the show, and like 98% of it was, isn't BC great? Isn't it going in the right direction? Ain't I a great premier? And then she has this one thing, you know, well, I do make tough decisions. And I think the way she worded it, as I've learned in the Bible, you know, this is, it's better to take a long perspective than a short perspective, which I actually think is probably the Christian church's view, because if you take the long run, you have more control. But I digress. But it didn't really seem like a thrilling endorsement. It wasn't like she's saying, well, I learned from the Bible that I need to support this because it says in Psalms 13 that thou shalt do something. I mean, it seemed to be just, she could have said the same thing that I was reading a book by Gandhi, or in the Homer's Iliad, it says that you need strength in order to conquer your enemies. It didn't sound as like a ringing endorsement of any particular religion at all, or even the Bible. It was more of a half-handed comment.
Yeah, it in some ways seems sort of forced in there, and sort of, you know, just the politically expedient. I mean, her party's down in the polls, especially on the right wing. The BC Conservatives, very strong social conservative party, is coming up and maybe stealing some of these Christian right votes. So she might have been there just trying to pander. And like you said, she's blowing her own horn, talking about how great of a province this is.
A politician blowing their own horn. How unusual.
We need to be skeptical of those. But we weren't trying to, you know, single out her religious beliefs or, you know, deny that politicians should be allowed to hold religious beliefs. I think we were just trying to draw attention to the possibility that our politicians may be basing their decisions not on objective evidence, but on faith and ideology. And I think that's something everyone, especially those listening to this show, should be concerned about.
Now, I guess this kind of leads to two questions. And the first one is kind of open, and we'll see how you go with this. So, what role should religion or religious beliefs play in governance? I think I know what you're going to say, but let's hear it.
Well, no. Douglas Todd quoted me in the Vancouver Sun on his blog and then put words into my mouth saying that I think no one should, or the only politician should be atheist, but that's clearly wrong. I think no one should be barred from office regardless of their religion or lack thereof, but a responsible elected representative, especially those like Christy Clark, who's the leader of a province, they ought to try to represent the diversity of the entire province. So Christy Clark, by going and finding an evangelical Christian talk show and then awkwardly sort of forcing the Bible into it, is sort of playing favorites with a very slim majority or a very slim minority of the citizens of BC. You know, she's picking out one faith and saying, these are the people I want to talk to, and we're going to ignore the rest of the province. In the 2001 census, only 55% of the province identified as some form of Christian. So, and with recent polls indicating that religion is only important to about 1 in 3 people in this province, you know, secularism has increased, fewer people are religious, the premier is really talking to less than half of the province by going on this show and seeking out this audience. So if she really wants to represent everyone fairly, she needs to either try to get on every kind of religious show, go on the Hindu show, go on the Muslim show, go on some secular and some multicultural shows, or she can keep her religious views sort of a little more private like we're used to in Canada. Pierre Trudeau said, let's keep the state out of the bedroom. Well, maybe let's keep the church out of the government.
Now, I this is going to sound a little harsh, and I apologize because I am guilty of this in my own speakings and all that. But I noticed that in one or two of the articles that I was reading, there was a picture of Christy Clark dressed up in the veil at a Sikh temple in India, which, I mean, gave the veneer that she may be much more ecumenical when it comes to her pandering to the electorate. So when you made this particular comment, have you gone out to see, maybe she has been on, you know, Catholic radio shows, maybe she has gone to Hindu stations, or is this something you have the feeling about this, but like with anything, you hit where the story was hot?
Well, we haven't seen the evidence. Like, it hasn't been presented to us. No one's really come forward and been like, here's all the shows that Christy Clark goes on in a year. We see more and more of our politicians actually scaling back the number of questions they'll take. So they're sort of closing off. Christy Clark herself is a, quote, devout Anglican, which
well, is interesting. Well, I tracked down the quote where she said that. But she also said that her beliefs are intensely personal, mm-hmm. which would imply that she does have the idea that there's sort of a separation of church and state. You may not like how she comes out her views, but it seems she realizes that, you know, they should at least seem to be separate.
Well, if her words are that she believes they are personal, it's interesting that she chooses to go on an evangelical Christian talk show in the first place and bring up the Bible. They're not matching. There's a
disconnect.
Yeah, a disconnect between those two sort of statements.
Okay. Well, you know, and the second question that kind of comes up, it is kind of a reality, you know, that the world is full of sort of religious memes. You know, it kind of predicates our culture. It's also, and sadly, in my opinion, that the majority of people do have some sort of spiritual beliefs. I mean, you mentioned 55% are Christian. There's a certain number of those who would be Sikh, Hindu, Muslims, yada, yada. You know, so the idea of someone who base their decision-making on the spiritualism of their faith, irrespective of what that might be, does seem to be something that would be popular with the majority of people in the province, at least on one level. So, you know, politicians who sort of, you know, do the tip and a nod to religion, it doesn't seem to be really that inappropriate. And in that sense, isn't sort of the idea that they must be completely secular and our politicians are completely secular a bit of a disconnect with the realities of both politics, but also the demographics of our society?
Well, let's not say our statement was overblown. All we did do was put out a press release and put it on our website. We do a lot more than, you know, just advocate for a secular state, which is important. I'll come back to that. You know, our group exists primarily to build sort of the humanist community across BC. We have meetings every week. We invite speakers. And we're working to establish groups in underrepresented areas. And hopefully soon we'll be performing the first humanist weddings in the province. So this one statement isn't like we're always going out there and attacking religion and trying to fight for the secular state. But you say tipping the nod to religious belief may not be inappropriate just because the majority views it that way, but that's not how the argument works. You know, just because the majority views something as okay doesn't mean it's okay. In this case, I like to think that we strongly agree that a secular state is a thing we should strive for. So we should be working for
Not wanting to answer my own question, but perhaps we could take a look at history where things like racism was considered to be, you know, so pandering to the white crowd, which is still the majority in this province, and, you know, tipping a nod to that. That, I mean, even if that is sort of in a sort of weird practical sense a good thing to do, it is definitely in a moral and a progressive sense a horrible thing to do. So that, you know, even though there may be these cultural memes in society and all that, that it seems that they tend to be far more divisive, and that one of the things that a secular point of view, even if privately you may have arrived at them differently, although we hope you don't, but that if you present them in a purely secular sort of manner, then at least that eliminates one of the tensions, one of the divisions that society has. I mean, you mentioned 55% are Christian, but 45% or something else, and that is implicitly a divisive feature of our society.
Well, even within that Christian community, they're not all church-going evangelical Christians. There's lots of Anglicans, United Church, Catholics, and then Protestants and evangelicals in there. It's a huge, diverse audience. So to speak to this entire diverse province, like you say, we need to sort of appeal to these secular values and secular arguments. And what we really hope politicians are doing is appealing to evidence and objective reasons for doing things. Should we, you know, coming back to the pipeline, should we accept it or reject it? Well, that should be based on, you know, the environmental science, the economic debates. We shouldn't be going, you know, job, you know, it can't go back to ideology, right? We need to have some science behind our arguments.
So in an odd sort of way, the sort of the Protestant idea of progress, that we need to do the pipeline because we need to, you know, we were given dominion over the earth is wrong, But conversely, and I don't mean any offense to our native people, but the ones who say that the land is sacred, and that strictly because there are the spirits of the woods, we shouldn't build the pipeline either. Both of those are equally ineffective arguments, where really what we should be doing is, like, what will be the damages, what will be the benefits in a sort of more independent means.
Yeah, and well, when you go to the native arguments, they do have a lot of undealt with treaties and land issues, and they can appeal to those arguments. But sort of I don't like the term, but it fits here, the environmental religion of, you know, almost technophobia. We can't go forward. Any scientific progress is dangerous. That's a thing we should try to avoid too.
And that sounds like a perfect way for a segue for our break, the environmental religion. We're going to go for a bit of a break, and we'll be right back after this.
Subscribe to the Radio Free Thinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
Back with our extended interview with Ian Bushfield, the BC Humanist Executive Director. So there's been some interesting items in the news besides our own premiere. Some will know that the U.S. Democratic Party is holding its convention in Charlotte, North Carolina, September 3rd to 6th, while the Republicans plan to have theirs in Tampa, Florida, August 27th to 30th. In anticipation of that, the American Atheists, a group that has been working to ensure the civil liberty of atheists and the total and absolute separation of government and religion since 1959, has placed a billboard campaign to forward sort of their cause. Now, I'm going to try and describe the billboards here and my great language of description. So one of them says, in the left-hand side, Christianity, sadistic God or useless savior, 3,000-plus versions of truth, promotes hatred, calls it love. Atheism, simply reasonable. And it's a call to join the American Atheists. Now, they have another one, which, oddly enough, no one in Tampa, Florida is going to portray. That's where the Republicans are having theirs. And it's about Mormonism. I'm not sure why they'd be more sensitive to that than anywhere else. But it says Mormonism. God is a space alien. Baptizes dead people. Big money, bigotry. Atheism, simply reasonable. So, Ian, are we going to see any of these sort of billboards coming up about Christy Clark about that, but or not? I mean, sorry. What are your thoughts about this? This is billboards and atheism is quite a common thing, but this seems to be a more forceful one than normal. Again, God hates.
Yeah, it's very interesting. With any sort of billboard campaign, I like to think of what are the objectives you have going in, and then have some, you know, design and advertising and discussion about what message you can do to create that objective and solve that issue. So I don't know exactly what the American Atheists were going for here. If their goal was to piss a lot of people off and get a lot of attention, they probably succeeded. But as we've seen with any billboard campaign, putting up a billboard that says, some people don't believe in God, period, still upsets a lot of people. So I don't know, the tone of these billboards can go all over the place, and the media will always find someone who goes, that's offensive to me.
I think maybe, I mean, there's always been this big debate in the atheist community versus sort of the hardcore, what I would call fundamentalist evangelical atheists, you know, those who are out there, and they're always pushing and they're really hardcore. And I mean, they're never going to win over new converts, and they're not really intended to do that, but they're intended to bring into the conversation things that are awkward and ugly, and I don't want to be rude about this, but the Catholic Church kind of is responsible for millions of deaths in Africa because of condoms. You know, I mean, you know, so they do have that sort of purpose.
Well, that's the idea of the Overton window. That's the sort of area we can have our discussion. And this keeps getting shifted one way or the other, depending on who's being the loudest. And so by being very militant and angry and loud, we can shift the debate more into our own field, where then our diplomats and our nicer, friendly atheists can sort of have a discussion that isn't just, hi, I'm an atheist, and people freak out. Now they can go, well, look, you're not as bad as that guy who put up the American Atheist billboard that called us bigots and...
and such, yeah.
And such.
I wonder why they didn't put one up against Scientology. Probably too litigious, but... That being said, maybe part of it, too, is I don't know if you know much about the American political scene, but religion has become one of the major themes in this election, and there does seem to be a whole bunch of things about, you know, the idea of contraception. You know, it's odd, and one of the quotes I often hear is that a lot of Republicans believe the government should have nothing to do with anyone but a woman's vagina, you know, that it has no role but legislating that. So as a BC humanist... when it comes to things like reproductive technologies and all those sort of things, where does it stand?
Well, so humanism in Canada started about, or organized humanism in Canada started about 50, 60 years ago. And one of the first leaders of this movement was Dr. Henry Morgenthaler, who actually led the fight in Canada to legalize abortion. So humanism in Canada has long been behind women's reproductive rights and their, you know, right to choose what they can do with their own body.
Does the BC Humanist, is it an international linked organization, or is this a sort of an isolated group?
So we were founded as a branch of Humanist Canada in the early 80s, and then we became our own group, our own sort of founding documents. And then there was some messes at Humanist Canada because free thought organizations like to implode and rebuild. And so we distance ourselves for a bit, but we're on good speaking terms now. And so we're affiliated organizations with Atheist Alliance International, Humanist Canada, and maybe the International Humanist and Ethical Union.
See, that's one of the hindrances, or one of the Achilles heel of any sort of truly skeptical movement, is because one of the tenets is to always question and to always sort of, you know, well, could we do it better? Could we do it better? It does. It'll lead to these things that, well, we believe this in the beginning, but now it doesn't seem to be tenable, or maybe there's a better way, and you get these implosions. Whereas if you're just one of these sheepish, dogmatic religious groups or something like that, don't ask questions and everything will be the same.
Well, I think it's a bit of a misguided idea that atheist groups are the only groups to ever implode. You look at any sort of smaller nonprofit, and they'll tend to get run by one very charismatic person, and everyone's got their flaws. So eventually someone's going to be really annoyed at that person, and, you know, egos are going to boil up, and nonprofits blow up all the time, especially the smaller ones. I like to sort of draw the analogy of, why do we have a Marxist party and a communist party in Canada? Well, because fringe ideas don't always get along. Not that we're necessarily a fringe idea, but...
Well, and you got Marxists, Trotskyists, yeah, and communists, and yeah. And actually, you even get it in groups that have nothing to do with nonprofits. Or, I mean, Scientology right now is in the verge of spawning off its own sort of cults or sects. It depends on how you...
Can a cult groups. Spawn a cult?
Yeah, well, that's very interesting. Who knows? Cultettes. So perhaps the last word on religion. You may have heard the CBC has been reporting today that the PQ in Quebec have been proposing a secular charter that will, if only, ensure that civil and paracivil servants show no overt religious symbols. So, I mean, they can have a crucifix on them, but it has to be, like, under their shirt. They would also sort of remove religious symbols from public and parapublic. I never heard the term parapublic before until I read this, and I understand what it means, but I love the term parapublic. Anyhow, so they were going to remove religious symbols from public and parapublic institutions. Of course, that said, they were going to make an exception for the crucifix on the National Assembly, and they had pointed out that, you know, religion is an important part of Quebec history, and they didn't want to diminish that. So any thoughts on that? Does the Humanist Association, does it have a secular charter that it would want government to adopt?
We haven't written anything for BC to adopt yet. The Quebec situation is very interesting because French have sort of a slightly different view of secularism than I think English Canada does. We look at sort of France and Quebec. They have this sort of very almost anti-theistic version of secularism where they want to expunge all religious symbols, which in some ways is appealing to anti-theists and atheists, but in other ways it also looks a little xenophobic. because sometimes it seems like, you know, they want to bend the veil because maybe they don't like religion, or maybe they just hate Muslims and people, immigrants. So I always am a little bit cautious and skeptical about this. But on the face, their press release talks a lot about building a secular society to establish women's rights, and that human rights will take precedent over religious freedoms, which is an interesting argument.
Well, and it's also interesting too, because I mean, Quebec of all the provinces is quite eager, maybe that's too strong of a word, willing to use the notwithstanding clause for something. And I could see that if you had one of these secular charters, that some people say, well, it would be deemed unconstitutional. And of all the parties in all the provinces, the Quebec, the PQ and Quebec are probably the only ones who would be willing to sort of pull the trigger on the gun sort of thing to go notwithstanding. I also find it kind of interesting, too. I mean, there's a lot of talk about the hijab and the veil. The veil less so, but I mean, things like the hijab are actually very European as well. I mean, if you look at any of the Mediterranean cultures, Greek, Spanish, Italian, even Eastern Europeans, they often wear the headscarf. It's just part of their thing. And as nothing particularly to do with religion, although it has everything to do with sort of the subjugation of women and the whole modesty sort of thing. Now, one of the differences between, I think, Radio Free Thinker and other skeptical shows is that we like to apply skepticism to social scientists. It seems that humanism similarly goes beyond religion. So how does humanism sort of approach topics like social justice? I mean, what is social justice from a humanist point of view?
Well, this is actually a topic I just wrote a piece about for our blog, so I don't know.
Coincidental.
Yeah, that was a coincidence. I like to think of social justice as just the idea of recognizing the dignity and value of every member of society and seeking effective ways to realize that dignity. And this is exactly what humanism is about. I mean, humanism is reason and compassion, the latter half of which is entirely about cultivating human dignity. So humanists should be very concerned with using the tools of scientific skepticism to make the world a better place. And so putting these beliefs into action, like I said, humanists were the first group in Canada to call for legalized abortions with Dr. Henry Morgenthaler in charge of Humanist Canada, which he eventually won that right. More recently and locally, the BC Humanists have been marching in the Vancouver Pride Parade in support of LGBTQ rights for the past 3 years. And we're currently partnering with the Foundation Beyond Belief to raise money for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society to fight blood cancers. Our group's raised over $2,000, and we're one of the most successful freethought groups in North America, which I'm quite proud of.
Cool.
We also support Harambe, which is a charity founded by a local humanist, Laurie Williams. It builds schools in Africa for girls, and the evidence shows that education is one of those keys to sort of fight poverty and improve the status of women around the world, so we're very proud of that connection. And finally, we're just at the point right now launching a social justice caucus, and this kind of this group will help find more causes that we can support and do more good work.
So you mentioned two terms here that, again, are bandied around, and we've talked about them here on the show itself. One is the idea of scientific skepticism. And then you also use the word dignity. Now, I think we can give sort of a shorthand answer as to what scientific skepticism is, but dignity strikes me to be a much more amorphous sort of idea. So, thoughts on either?
Well, scientific skepticism is the easy one to define. You know, just apportion your beliefs to the evidence and then apply the critical tools of science. Dignity has to do with sort of building up human worth, which is not any more clear of an answer. Someone who has dignity has sort of freedoms, human rights. They have the ability to move freely around society. They have the ability to move, you know, it's not a caste system or a very class-structured system. People can interact. There's not sort of systemic discrimination against people. And you can sort of go and live a fulfilling life without fear.
I think fear.
Well, fear of oppression, fear of tyranny, fear of
an afterlife.
Fear of dying or being killed.
But that also could be applied to something like libertarians who say, well, you know, I want to be completely independent. I don't want to have anything. Now, granted, fear of dying, okay, that's a little hard for libertarians to deal with. But there still seems to be, I mean, what about measures of happiness or stuff like that? You know, I mean, sometimes there's a certain amount of, I hate to use this, word it this way, but I can't think of a better one, a certain amount of suffering that makes life worth living. One of the great examples is the idea of games. The games is the idea of taking a simple task and making it more difficult, and we find enjoyment in that difficulty. How does dignity play into that?
Well, dignity is not a replacement for I'm not talking about hedonism. I'm not talking about we should all just go get drunk and have parties all the time and just have that good life. But the issue I see, so we want to promote human freedom, so we want to promote human liberties. But where I see the divergence from libertarianism is that this libertarian idea doesn't work. When you sort of let people be free, we aren't very nice to each other. We need a little bit of structure to keep ourselves in line. And that's, we don't want too much structure. That's obviously bad too, but we can find a balance, sort of a democratic way of building a constructive society. So we see those global happiness products always seem to be the highest in secular northern European states, which have a very strong welfare state. So people can do well, but then they also help prevent people from falling into abject poverty.
I think one of the ideas that can play on this and where it becomes interesting is the idea is how do you define as a sort of secularist what is a right? Because, a right is an absolute thing, or it tends to strike to be as an absolute thing. And to do that, you almost have to assert it, as in, I have faith or I believe this should be a right. And that seems to be antithetical to the idea of scientific skepticism, at least on the surface.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to phrase that. I don't think there are sort of these, natural rights that we have. Rights only exist within societies that can sort of prevent other people from taking them away. So the rights that we sort of laid out in the charter, the right to association, the right to freedom of conscience, the right to free press, and so forth, the right to free speech, seem to be useful.
Well,
coming about it scientific skeptically, we look at the results of societies that are built on sort of rights and freedoms, and they seem to produce happier societies than ones without that.
And I think this is, again, having in the last show kind of condemned Sam Harris, and you should never, worship the person, but sometimes everyone can have a good idea. And I think his idea with the moral landscape is that we can, at least with historical evidence, say that some ideas tend to produce better results than other ideas. So slavery seems to produce societies that end up being sort of a negative sum overall, whereas societies that promote an egalitarian point of view tend to be better. So that doesn't mean all egalitarian societies are equal, but on average that seems to be a better point of view than ones that promote ideas of slavery.
Yeah, it's sort of the utilitarian approach to ethics. Let's look at sort of a broader society. What kind of rules and society produces happier people? More fulfilled people.
Yeah, and that also leads into the idea, too, I think one of the tensions, and you hinted at it in what you were saying, is that we often think of rights as individual rights. And I think part of that is largely American, to a certain degree, the French Revolution, those sort of things. But one of the memes, especially in Marxist and socialist thinking, is community rights, as in the rights of sort of the society. And that often there's a balance, a juxtaposition between the two rights, and that ultimately, I think where the idea of dignity lies is finding the balance between community rights versus individual rights.
Well, even just with individual rights, you'll see them come into competition all the time. And that's where sort of our courts have to decide, does your right to free speech trample my right to security of the person, or vice versa? And so our courts are sort of set up to balance rights and try to maximize freedom while minimizing harm.
So do BC Humanists think corporations are people? Sorry.
I don't know if our organization has a policy or position on that.
Do you have a position?
I don't think. Personally, no. I don't think so. I think legally there's benefits to our current system of, giving some rights to corporations and taking liabilities off of the board of directors and putting it into a nebulous entity. But whether that can go too far, I would think so.
Well, and that sort of segues in, because corporations have been big in the news as well with regards to things like, oil. And we mentioned before the Northern Gateway Pipeline and all that. So you kind of alluded to before, BC Humanists have views on everything almost. Environmentalism. So we kind of talked about the cult of environment, which seems to be a bad thing. Do BC Humanists in general have any unique insight to any current environmental issue.
Well, before I get to that, I liked your term, we have views on everything, because if you come to one of our meetings, our members will argue any point with you, and we don't always have unanimous views. So don't take my word as the law of humanism here. We can go off and meet a bunch of humanists who will disagree about everything I say. But coming back to the environment, humanists generally believe that, or humanists do agree that we evolved from lower forms of life, or from previous forms of life, earlier forms of life on this planet. And so we recognize that we're a part of the environment. We're an integral part. And we also notice that we've had a huge effect on this environment. I mean, look at the studio we're in. Look at the city we're in. We've completely changed this former rainforest into a shiny tower, a city of glass towers. So we have a huge effect on the environment. And, we do lots of agriculture, fishing, forestry, mining, and burning fossil fuels like never before. So looking at the scientific consensus, we are causing the world to warm faster than ever. And based on the predictions of the scientists, there's not many optimistic ones. So I think humanists see a moral imperative to argue for science-based solutions to the challenges that are facing the environment in our society. And we should be open to taking a hard look at all possible options, including wind turbines and hydro and solar, but also even nuclear power.
And now realizing that we're probably going to slip between this association and yourself, but what about the idea? I mean, you mentioned dignity, and there's the sense of egalitarian inequality. And one of the most painful aspects about climate change in particular is the fact that the developed countries have had a really good time. They have achieved a very high level of living standards. They've developed extraordinarily well. And now that we've sort of achieved this, it seems like the bill has come in and it's causing an environmental crisis. So now we have to turn to developing countries who are gradually coming up to where we are and say, no, you can't have what we have, because if you do, we're all dead. And that strikes me as a rather hard pill for a lot of people to swallow.
Well, we can turn it around and we can say, we screwed up. What we did too fast and we didn't think long term. That doesn't mean we can't develop smartly. We have learned a lot of lessons about how to develop cities, about how to develop efficient economies and efficient infrastructures. So I don't think right now we have to turn to Africa and say, don't develop. We can't turn to developing countries and yell at them to put the brakes on, because we're still causing most of the problem. You look at the output of CO2, and it's mostly North America. Even Europe is better than us.
True, although I think just recently China per capita, as a nation, has surpassed the United States, and that was sort of one of the, ooh. Okay, so we're going to take another bit of a break here. Ethan is sweating harshly after my willow. No, we're going to take a bit of a break, have a bit of a relax, after we go for this bit of a break. Did I say break already?
You call me Ethan.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back. So I was reading recently on the Humanist site that you guys sort of support suicide. Okay, I know. That's a little harsh to put it that way. We here at Radio Free Thinker have expressed our own support for the right to die. First, why does your group support this particular stance?
Well, let's just make sure we're clear here. Humanists, like I said, value human dignity, and we think it's a tragedy when either mental illness, depression, or bullying causes someone who's otherwise healthy to take their life. And we should be doing far more to prevent these needless deaths. That being said, our support for human dignity extends to that time when someone's terminally ill and is coming to the end of their life. You know, so we support, we're strong supporters of the right to die with dignity. No one should be forced to suffer, you know, watch a loved person suffer the trauma of a slow, painful, and dehumanizing death. We afford compassionate euthanasia to our pets. You know, you think we could do that to our fellow human beings?
That sounds good. So, but that, of course, inevitably leads to the whole, you know, argument that the right to die inevitably leads to coerced suicide. So how do you deal with that?
Well, we can look at several case studies. Over the past several years, the state of Oregon has had legalized assisted suicide. And that law that they passed, which came about through a number of citizens' referendums, and the government was really hesitant to bring it in, that law has become the most studied health public policy in history. What they find is that all these sort of fears and doomsayers are completely misplaced. Doctors aren't, you know, mass killing patients. In fact, many of those who follow the process, and it's a few month process, you have to, you know, prove you're terminally ill, and then you have to get a doctor's note and get another doctor's note, and then they get the prescription to hasten their death, they end up not using it. And the reason for this is, I think, that they get sort of the option and they get sort of the choice, and that alone restores their dignity and they feel more human because they're in control of their end of life, you know. Well, just further to that, there's a few other places other than Oregon. Washington and the Netherlands have also had different levels of, or different regimes in terms of assisted suicide and euthanasia. And what we also find about them is they tend to put more emphasis on palliative care than places with fewer end-of-life options, which is also very interesting, because one of the other arguments is that, oh, we should just put money into palliative care and just treat people better while they're ending their life. But, you know, it's not an either-or option. We can treat people better and give them choice and freedom.
And actually, I remember watching a documentary about Digitas in Switzerland, where a lot of people, notably Brits, will tend to go to do end-of-life sort of thing. And I believe they said that they only have about 1 in 4 or 1 in 5 actually go through with the whole process, and that the majority of people just like to know that they have that option available to them when things get too bad.
Well, yeah, Switzerland's the really interesting case, because 50 or more years ago, they just abolished all laws about assisted suicide and euthanasia. So now it's sort of the open regime. Like, relative to the Netherlands, there's a bunch of laws in place that sort of regulate it in Oregon and Washington. Switzerland, there's no law. It's sort of like abortion in Canada. There's no law regulating it. And so the doctors generally set up a way to handle it.
So that must mean that the population of Switzerland has been plummeting because everyone's been offing themselves.
I don't think so.
No, I think that would have shown up in the news. So a little off topic, and as you may know, the Americans are having an election. There have been a number of issues raised that have residents here in Canada, especially considering we have a conservative government. I guess I sort of have two questions. First, what do you think will be sort of the big issue to come out of the election? This is more personal than the BC Humanist.
I mean, in terms of the big issue, the U.S. is still recovering from its recession, and it's, you know, a very slow recovery, and we could get an economist here like your, or a political scientist like yourself to talk about those reasons.
Okay.
But so I think most Americans are just going to be thinking about their jobs and, you know, will they be able to afford to feed their family? And so on the one hand, Obama's taken sort of a mild Keynesian approach to solving, you know, restoring the economy. And Romney sort of wants to go hard right Randian and just like cut government and suddenly people will be better off. But I think because things are we're starting to see some improvement, I don't see this like groundswell coming to oppose Obama. And so I think people will be happy with that. On the social policy side, I've been personally glad to see Obama take very strong positions in support of gay marriage and women's reproductive rights. Time will tell whether these translate into real policies if he's reelected, or if they end up sort of like the healthcare bill, where he starts off very strong and then sort of waters it down. But the bill he did pass was a marked improvement over what America had.
There's always before. The danger, though, with these particular issues is that once you've kind of made them a campaign point, so again, you know, LGBT equality, the Defense of Marriage Act, or the Undefense of Marriage Act, I guess, because he's not supporting that anymore. Gays in the military, immigration laws, those sort of things, women's contraception, is that if he loses, those are things now that are sort of lightning bolts for the Republicans to get rid of. Whereas if he had supported these a year ago, right, or even a little longer than that, it would have been, okay, he passed them, but it's not a campaign issue. But now that it's a campaign issue, that seems in my mind to put them more at risk. I mean, good that he does them, and I'm glad he did it.
I think it's important to look at the timing. Like, he didn't bring gay marriage up a week before the election. He brought it up like 6-8 months.
A week after Biden came out?
Yeah, basically. But I think, well, part of it, I think, had to do with shoring up his base and making sure he would have the volunteers and feet on the ground when the real campaign sort of started. So this wasn't necessarily like, I want to fight the Republicans on it, as I want to remind the Democrats to show up. And so he was trying to like bring his party back and bring his people back to him.
Well, that actually segues into my second question, sort of about the American election. I sort of have a theory that whatever happens in American politics shows up here in Canada and about a decade or so later. Most notably, we had the robocall scandal earlier this year, which if you were a political pundit, you would have known the Americans had the same thing about in the late 90s or so. So what do you think will be sort of a big takeaway for Canadians with regards to the U.S. election? What can we see in them that we maybe should keep an eye out here?
Well, I'm going to call you out on that little pet theory and say it's a very selective view of history. I mean, I could equally make the case that Canada is the one leading the way and the U.S. follows us on issues like the death penalty, like the right to abortions, and like gay marriage. So on social issues, I would say Canada's leading the way and the U.S. is reluctantly following us. But with respect to this issue, I recall reading a recent poll where, Obama's the by and far preferred choice of the vast majority of Canadians. They polled sort of him, Romney, or none, or sort of I don't know yet. And Obama got 65% support across the country. Romney got 9% support. Even people who admitted to voting for the Conservatives, 50% of them still supported Obama, and only 25% sort of gave him the thumbs down. So if we remember back from the 2008 campaign, Obama is very big on campaigning. Like, he's effective at it. He inspires people. So if he can do that again, it's going to really speak to a lot of Canadians and just get people excited again.
So one, just to defend myself, actually, I think Roe versus Wade is before Morgenthaler's court case. So we did have a semi-legalization of abortion prior to the Roe versus Wade. And I do think there were some American states that had outlawed executions prior to when Canada abandoned it, but I will go back with that. But what about the ideas of, I mean, one of the things that we sort of talked about is the sort of appealing to the base. And I think we noticed that with Harper in the last election, where he sort of narrow focused on particular groups to try and get them out to vote for him. And one of the odd things, especially with Romney's selection of Paul Ryan as his thing, is that it doesn't seem that they're trying to convert the undecided. It's that they're trying to bring out their base. And some people worry that things like campaign financing, advertising, limitations as far as voter ID and all that, that it's becoming not so much about winning the election, but about skewing the election in such a way as to arrive at your own view.
Well, the way the Canada and American system seem to be set up is elections aren't decided by who shows up, but by who doesn't. So if you get all your supporters to show up, and the other guy can't, or the other woman can't get their supporters to come to the polls, you'll win by default. So it's, shoring up that base and making sure everyone comes to the polls. And this, you could take that as a very cynical view of politics, if you want.
Speaking of shoring up one's base, let's do that now. So I'd like to thank Ian for dropping into the studio. Is there any last word you'd like to leave our listeners?
Yeah, I'd encourage everyone to check out our website at bchumanist.ca and follow us on all the social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, YouTube, and Meetup right now. And yeah, we have a number of events coming up, so follow our website.
Well, speaking of a number of events, I think it's time for our skeptic highlights. So I'm going to do a few that I have here, then I'll end the show with Ian giving off the myriad of events that the BC Humanist Society is having. So, Cafe Inquiry is having a Limits of Growth. Speaker Patrick Walden will be discussing whether there are limits to growth. When will our endless drive for continuing expansion hit the wall? Will civilization collapse in the 21st century? I vote maybe. Pat Watson is a research scientist at the Triumph Synchrotron Laboratory at UBC. From what I understand, he's actually gone into the future, found out what happened, and has come back to warn us all. That's just my pet theory. Admission for this is free. However, donations are welcome. They need the money to help keep these things going. It is at room 227, the Saunders Industrial Policies Room at SFU Harbor Center, downtown Vancouver. The next Tuesday, not this Tuesday, but next Tuesday, is Skeptics in the Pub downtown. Every month, skeptics gather around the watering hole for camaraderie, stimulating discussion, and to enjoy a pint or two. The next event is, like I say, Tuesday around 7:30-ish. It's at the back room of the Railway Club, second floor at the corner of Dunsmuir and Seymour. Now, everyone remembers Skeptic Camp, and if you haven't, well, keep your ears open because there's another Skeptic Camp coming up. But in order for a Skeptic Camp to happen, there needs to be planning. And there's a planning meeting planned this Saturday at 2 p.m. at the large meeting room at Waves, as that's Howell and Smith, where anyone who's interested to help plan, coordinate, or speak at the next Skeptic Camp is encouraged to attend. Now, remember, showing up doesn't mean you will have to actually take any responsibilities, just to get your voice out there and to let them know that people are really interested. So I'd encourage you to show up. Ian, do you have any highlights?
Just a couple. Tomorrow evening, we're actually going to do another social hike around Lynn Canyon. So humanists who just want to get some fresh air and chat while they get some exercise can join us. We'll be doing that at 6 p.m. This Friday, we're really excited. We're having political scientist Edwin Hodge into town. He's coming down from UBC Okanagan, and he's off to University of Victoria starting soon. And he's going to speak about hate speech on the internet. His specific research has to deal a lot with sort of white supremacy movements, so he'll have a lot to say about the recent shooting in Wisconsin and about Canada's recent, or our federal government's recent repealing of Section 13 of the Human Rights Act, which has to deal with hate speech on the internet. And so that event's at 7 p.m. at the Oak Ridge Public Library. And after that, we're heading to Portland Craft on Main Street to have some drinks cool. with Edwin. I think, and then on Sunday after our meeting, we have our meetings every Sunday at 10 a.m. at the Oak Ridge Senior Center in the mall there. After our meeting, we're going to have a secular parenting and family barbecue over at Columbia Park at 42nd and Columbia Street.
That
so there'll be some
fun.
Food.
And actually, that brings up an interesting topic, and we didn't really have time to talk about it on the show, but we have a few minutes here at the end. One of the things I've noticed, a lot of events, at least recent events, seem to be very much sort of family-orientated events. And how does humanism, I mean, you have a parent, how to be a good parent sort of thing, you have a lot of family activities. Is that like a big focus of the BC Humanists, is to get this sort of family outreach?
It hasn't really been before, but I think it's a huge gaping hole sort of in our movement is, you know, people have children and then they say, I want my children to learn a bit of morals and ethics. And they can't get that in public schools, and except in Quebec now. And so they sometimes turn to churches, whether it's Unitarians or worse. And so we're just trying to offer that secular alternative where we can network some parents and start building a secular ethical culture.
So the idea is to provide an ethical foundation that's not based on a religious one.
Yeah, exactly.
Good. And the outreach is always good. And again, the whole idea of building a community. I mean, one of the strengths that the church tends to have is this sort of support structure that it will use as, you know, to keep everyone up. And I mean, there's no innate reason why there cannot be sort of, well, I don't want to use the Church of Humanism because that may go into something else. But it's good to see out there. Anyhow, this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
Thanks.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com. And subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars.